Hello, friends and colleagues, and welcome to episode 119 of Dermasphere, the podcast by dermatologists, for dermatologists, and for the dermatologically curious. I am one of your hosts. My name is Luke Johnson. I'm a pediatric dermatologist and a general dermatologist with the University of Utah. And joining us, of course, is...
This is Michelle Tarbox. I am an associate professor of dermatology and dermatopathology at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in beautiful, sunny Lubbock, Texas.
Our mission, of course, is to come to you every 2 weeks to bring you discussions of some of the latest articles in the world of clinical dermatology, so you don't feel like you have to spend as much time flipping through journal articles or clicking on email links, because perhaps you can get the information you need right here from us, and also from our friend the Pimping Bell. Say hello, Pimping Bell. The Pimping Bell chimes to highlight especially question-worthy or testable content, so when you hear the Pimping Bell, pay extra attention. Since we last spoke, listeners, I have been in Galveston, where I was invited to speak at the Houston Dermatological Society meeting, so thanks a lot to them and to all of our listeners that I met down there. We've got some fans in Galveston. We appreciate all of you guys.
I actually got to be at the Tennessee Dermatologic Society as well in Chattanooga, Tennessee, which was also lovely.
Always got to one-up me, Michelle. All right, let's talk about an article here. So it's out of the New England Journal, and it's called Bimekizumab versus Secukinumab in Plaque Psoriasis. This was a large group of people. The authors, first and last authors, are listed as Christian Reich and Andrew Blavelt. So if you've got bad psoriasis, you are living in a golden age. What an embarrassment of riches we have. Mm-hmm. And listeners, you may recall that Secukinumab, also called Cosentyx, Brodalumab, also called Siliq, and Ixekizumab, also called Taltz, inhibit IL-17. And they're very good at treating psoriasis. In fact, both Ixekizumab and Brodalumab were found to be two of the four, quote, best psoriasis biologics in a 2020 study that we discussed in episode 22 and then updated in episode 77. So take a listen to that if you want. And this new thing, Bimekizumab, Bimzelx?
I don't know. Bimzelx? I think Bimzelx.
B-I-M-Z-E-L-X.
Missing a vowel there. But no, great. Like it seems like you said it right. Sounds like it's missing a vowel.
It does. Bimzelx. Sounds like a... alien creature who's like, hey, stop eating our young. Futurama, anybody? So this medicine was approved in October 2023 and is another IL-17 blocker. This one is different, though, because it blocks two different isoforms of IL-17. IL-17A, which Ixekizumab and Secukinumab also block, as well as IL-17F. That's possibly bell-worthy.
Oh, yes.
Previous trials have showed that Bimekizumab was superior to placebo, to adalimumab, and also to ustekinumab. And so now they're trying it against Secukinumab. So this is pretty gutsy.
That's a big dog to try to take down.
I know, though not one of the four best psoriasis biologics in that study, but still awfully close, of course. And it's a great medicine. Mm-hmm. And as you might guess, since this was published in the New England Journal, their patients did very well, better even than the patients on Secukinumab. Wow. The only downside seemed to be an increased risk of mucosal candidal infections, such as thrush, which of course we might expect, because IL-17 seems to be involved in immunity in this regard. Mm-hmm. And the specific numbers were 19% in the Bimekizumab group versus 3% in the Secukinumab group. So quite a lot more, and one out of every five people getting something like this. Hmm. Fortunately, these candidal infections were mild to moderate and did not necessitate treatment interruption, and they usually responded well to antifungals, though they didn't mention if they were topical or PO. This, of course, was industry-funded, and it was a Phase 3B randomized controlled trial of adults with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis at 77 sites. They had a total of 743 patients, and they compared Bimekizumab at two different dosing schedules, every 4 weeks or every 8 weeks, versus standard dosing Secukinumab. So, PASI 100. We have talked about PASI before, P-A-S-I. It's the Psoriasis Area and Severity Index, and it kind of is supposed to give you an idea of how much better your psoriasis is after you've been on some medicine for some amount of time. So if you achieved PASI 50, then we can say your psoriasis is roughly like 50% better. And if you say, you know, PASI 75 is where you're at, then your psoriasis is 75% better than where it was when we first encountered it. And back in the day, we used to talk about PASI 50s. This is a little bit before my day, but back when the methotrexate was state of the art, people talked about PASI 50. And then some of the biologics came out and we started talking about PASI 75. And then we even got up to PASI 90. And now here we are. PASI 100 was their primary endpoint, completely clear of psoriasis. So if you wanted to be PASI 100 at week 16, if you were in the bimekizumab group, you had a 62% chance of getting there, secukinumab 49%. At week 48, so almost a year on these drugs, basically they were very similar to the numbers at week 16, 67% versus 46%. So amazing clearance, really, for both drugs, though bimekizumab did perform better. And they also looked at quality of life, so a DLQI, Dermatology Life Quality Index, score of 0 or 1, which is really good. At week 48, 78% of the patients in the bimekizumab group got there versus 70% in the secukinumab group. So they didn't really comment on whether or not that was enough of a difference to be clinically relevant, honestly. If you still have one or two little papules of psoriasis versus just none at all, does it really meaningfully impact your life? It's tough to say, but they're both in the ballpark and they both do a really good job. And then speaking of PASI 75, another metric they looked at was the percentage of patients who achieved PASI 75 at week 4, and it was 71% versus 47%, again favoring bimekizumab. So it looks really good if you don't mind getting thrush. The approved dosing is you get doses at week 0, 4, 8, 12, and 16, so monthly for like 4 months, and then it's every 8 weeks thereafter. Of course, we're also interested in cost, and it looks like it's $7,200 a dose, meaning for the first year, it's about $65,000. We can have a conversation if we wanted to about whether or not that is, quote, worth it, but it's definitely in the ballpark of the other psoriasis biologics that are out there. So this isn't like way more expensive than what's already available. And if you're comparing its cost specifically to secukinumab, then it requires dosing at weeks 0, 1, 2, 3, and 4, and then every 4 weeks thereafter. And it's $6,700 per dose, so it's about $100,000 for the first year. So bimekizumab, also significantly cheaper, at least based on these list prices I found on GoodRx, than secukinumab, plus it's dosed less frequently. So it's looking really good.
Mm-hmm.
They do comment on a couple other things. New diagnoses of inflammatory bowel disease have been reported in the IL-17 inhibitors. It doesn't seem like it's a real common side effect. It's, in fact, quite rare. They said across all the bimekizumab trials, remember they compared it to placebo, to adalimumab, to ustekinumab, 2 cases of ulcerative colitis were reported with this drug out of 1,300 patients altogether. So if you did have patients who were worried about it, you could say, well, you know, 599 out of 600 patients don't have to worry about this. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting that it happens. And maybe we should have another article where we look into the pathomechanism and does it unmask something that's already there, which would be my guess, versus sort of causing it de novo.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the story. And I mean, these guys are gutsy. They must think they have a really great drug on hand, which it looks like they do, because they're comparing it against all these other drugs, which are considered standard of care. So there's like 15 or so really good biologics in the psoriasis market these days. And it looks like these guys are trying to show that theirs is just better than all the others and we should use it. And again, it's tough to argue. It does look really good.
Yeah. In the IL-17 game, we've got the brodalumab, bimekizumab, secukinumab, and ixekizumab. Something interesting, if you kind of arrange them, is that bro and bem, like, so brodalumab is Cilic, and bimekizumab is Bimzelx. Those both hit more than just IL-17A. So brodalumab hits IL-17RA. And through that, it can impact like IL-17A, IL-17C, IL-17E, and IL-17F. And then bimekizumab hits IL-17A and F. Secukinumab and ixekizumab only hit IL-17A. Both brodalumab and bimekizumab had signals in their studies for suicidality. Only one in the bimekizumab one, so they don't have a REMS program like brodalumab does. But it does make you wonder if there's something with that F receptor that does something interesting. So that's one signal that came out of that, but they're not doing any extra monitoring or anything with bimekizumab as opposed to brodalumab, which they are.
Yeah. And whether or not that's truly associated with depression is also somewhat controversial. I think we've maybe talked about that a little bit before, too. But hey, thanks, drug companies, for creating all these great drugs for psoriasis. We really are in a good spot, and hopefully some of these drugs or drugs like them will be found to be helpful for some of our especially difficult conditions like, you know, hidradenitis suppurativa, which is always a boogeyman.
Mm-hmm. So psoriasis is scaly.
Sure is.
So let's talk about
ding, ding, ding. Where's the bell?
Ding, ding. Yeah, scaly psoriasis. So let's talk about other scaly things like hyperkeratoses. So this is an article, instead of using a bunch of novel and very expensive drugs that are amazing and do fantastic things for people with complex diseases, this is an article discussing a relatively older medication. One could even argue, because it's really elemental, that it's somewhat ancient in the treatment of hyperkeratotic disorders. So these are out of the Journal of Dermatologic Therapies from authors Philip Cohen and Cesar Anderson out of San Diego Family Dermatology and the University of California San Diego Hyperbaric Medicine and Wound Healing Center. Very exciting. And so this is looking at the use of topical selenium sulfide for the treatment of hyperkeratosis. Hyperkeratosis, as you know, is thickened skin, and it can be congenital or acquired. It affects the palms and soles typically, and it is often going to either be distributed in either a diffuse pattern, a focal pattern, or a punctate pattern. Microscopically, you can see hyperkeratosis through orthokeratosis of the stratum corneum. Topical treatments can involve keratolytics, such as urea, salicylic acid, or lactic acid. Retinoids, as they change gene expression in the keratinocytes and may normalize keratinization, and then physical debridement, as well as in cases of inflammatory conditions, topical corticosteroids, and then phototherapy using topical sorolins and UVA phototherapy or other localized therapeutic modalities. Selenium is a non-metallic essential element. It is water insoluble in a salt form, which is selenium sulfide. That's an active ingredient that's used either as a foam, lotion, or shampoo to treat seborrheic dermatitis and also tinea versicolor. So I think a lot of us are familiar with that. It's also just a little bit toxic to the hair follicle, so I don't love it as a shampoo, to be completely honest, but it is useful for a couple of other conditions.
Sorry, Selsun Blue is the common example of a brand name that carries this. That's why it's got SEL in the name, I presume, because its active ingredient is selenium sulfide.
I think you are correct about that. And then there's a clinical strength or something, Head and Shoulders, that's also got selenium sulfide in it. So this is a little case series of three individuals with hyperkeratoses from different causes who had hyperkeratosis of the palms and or soles. And the hyperkeratosis in all of these individuals was successfully treated with topical selenium sulfide in either a 2.5% solution, shampoo or lotion, or a 2.75% foam. And the response to the topical selenium sulfide was both rapid and complete, as well as sustained. And a couple of patients actually had therapeutic withdrawal with alternative therapies with recrudescence of the hyperkeratosis that then responded again to the reapplication of the selenium sulfide. None of the patients had adverse events secondary to the therapy, so they recommended that topical selenium sulfide could be added to the therapeutic armamentarium for congenital or acquired hyperkeratoses. So briefly, hyperkeratosis, of course, is thickening of the skin. Selenium sulfide can be topically used, as we said, for sebderm and tinea versicolor. In these three individuals with hyperkeratosis, specifically of the plantar feet, the thickened skin was successfully treated with the selenium sulfide. They described first a African-American woman who was 38 years old that had plantar hyperkeratosis. She'd had multiple different therapies tried for it, including salicylic acid, 3% without improvement. They tried topical selenium sulfide foam, 2.75%, which she applied to the feet and then rubbed that area to help it to lather and left it on for 10 minutes, then rinsed it off and then applied Aquaphor ointment daily as she had been previously doing, with excellent results and resolution of the plantar hyperkeratosis within 2 weeks. She then tapered the selenium sulfide therapy to every other day for 3 weeks as needed. And then if the hyperkeratosis reappeared, she was reinstructed to reapply that. So her feet remained clear from hyperkeratosis. She stopped her therapy and began treatment with ammonium lactate. When she did that, her plantar hyperkeratosis recurred. So she stopped the ammonium lactate and re-began the selenium sulfide with, again, resolution of the plantar hyperkeratosis. Their second case was a 32-year-old Caucasian man who had congenital hyperkeratosis with fissures of the palms and soles, and a sister who was similarly affected with Unethost disease. He also had poorly controlled diabetes, so it's important to manage a condition that's causing fissures in a patient under circumstances like this.
Remind us what Unethost disease is.
Unethost is one of the congenital palmoplantar hyperkeratoses, and I know we always talked about Unethost because it's keratin 1 mutation that causes it. Ding, ding, ding.
That's awesome. And this is the one that's diffuse. And
yes, it's a diffuse.
Transgradients.
I believe so. I would need you to check because I should have checked that before I presented this. Why don't you check for me and I'll come back to you on that one.
And transgradients, friends, means that the hyperkeratosis affects not just the bottom of the foot, but kind of like creeps up along the sides too.
Mm-hmm. So the unethos can be very difficult to treat. Have you ever treated any patients with that?
Yeah, actually, just a week or two ago, I had a patient in my clinic who has this and has tried a bunch of stuff that hasn't helped. And then sort of coincidentally / serendipitously, we were talking about another patient who had hyperkeratosis that was recalcitrant in grand rounds, and somebody mentioned selenium sulfide. And I was like, what the heck? And that's why we're talking about it today.
Yeah, I'm actually very excited about this because I literally just saw a patient in my clinic that has Vohwinkel's that's been very recalcitrant to treatment. And so I want to treat her for that. So she has pretty bad PPK with her Vohwinkel's. So this patient who had unethos had failed salicylic acid, ammonium lactate, high-potency corticosteroids. So they decided to go ahead and try the selenium sulfide 2.5% shampoo. He applied the shampoo and rubbed it into his feet until it lathered and then left it on for 10 minutes prior to rinsing, then applied Aquaphor ointment with excellent results and resolution of the plantar hyperkeratosis after 2 weeks. So after his treatment, he also began to use it on his hands. So he'd previously only used it on his feet. And then his hands were also responsive to therapy. He was able to tolerate the shampoo lather up to 2 hours at a time, after which he would rinse it off and put on the Aquaphor. So he was enthusiastically utilizing this and instructed his sister to use it as well, which I thought was cute that they included in the report. And then their case three was an 80-year-old African-American man who had extensive hyperkeratosis of the lower legs and feet associated with lymphedema of the lower extremities. And he had had multiple therapies, including compression wraps. He'd had a lot of topical therapeutics directed towards it, including ammonium lactate cream, which he'd had trouble tolerating at the 12% strength. So he decreased it to 5%, but still hadn't had improvement. So then he started to utilize the 2.5% selenium sulfide shampoo, which he lathered and allowed to remain onto the skin at 10 to 20 minutes prior to rinsing off and then applying Aquaphor with great results. So the hyperkeratosis in all of these patients was nicely responsive to selenium sulfide. The classification of hyperkeratosis can be determined by its manifestations on the skin. It can be diffuse, local, focal, or punctate. And it can also be caused in an acquired fashion from chemical induction, dermatosis-related, drug-related, idiopathic, or infection-related. There's something called keratoderma climactericum, which occurs in people after menopause. Malignancy-associated keratoderma can occur as well as malnutrition-associated and systemic disease-associated. There's hereditary palmoplantar keratoderma that can be limited to thickening of the palms or soles, or can be associated with syndromes that have other extracutaneous manifestations, including cardiomyopathy, deafness, or inborn errors of metabolism. And hyperkeratosis on histopathology tends to be orthokeratosis that's thickened. You can also sometimes see perikeratosis, retained nuclei and stratum corneum, acanthosis with thickening of the entire epidermis or hyperplasia of the granular layer or spinatum spinosum, and sometimes also inflammation. The congenital hyperkeratoses can also have changes in the epidermis, such as epidermolysis of the granular layer. So the initial treatment of acquired hyperkeratosis is usually aimed at the underlying cause of the condition. If a patient has idiopathic acquired keratosis or patients with hereditary hyperkeratosis, you can use conservative treatments that have kind of been previously discussed: urea, salicylic acid, lactic acid, physical debridement, topical retinoids, sorolins, UVA, or topical corticosteroids. I've used acitretin for some of my patients that have hyperkeratosis. But it's nice to have this option of selenium, which is a member of the group 4A of the periodic table. Other elements in this group are oxygen, sulfur, polonium, which I always like to say polonium for some reason, and tellurium. It's a non-metallic element, and it has 4 natural oxidative states. The water-soluble selenite and selenate salts are toxic, so selenium is not, and the selenium sulfide salt is relatively commonly used in topical therapeutics and very well tolerated. It is actually, selenium is an essential component of the antioxidant enzyme glutathione peroxidase. And selenium deficiency has actually been linked to some endemic diseases in the Chinese population, including Keshen disease, which can cause cardiac enlargement, congestive heart failure, and cardiogenic shock. This can occur in children and young women. And then another condition called Cashin-Beck disease, which causes shortened stature and necrosis of tubular bone. These are caused by selenium deficiencies. Excess selenium can also cause toxicity, though. So if you have acute ingestion of selenium acid, which is fatal, you can get garlic odor on your breath, red pigmentation of the hair, nails, and teeth. This is a way I feel like a dermatologist could solve a murder mystery. So like, I plan to write a little murder mystery with that in there because that would be very cool. And it can cause also changes of the skin. If you have high levels of selenium, patients can get chronic selenium poisoning that can be characterized by skin changes, including erythema with red discoloration, pruritic scalp rash with vesicles, and brittle hair and nails. Selenium sulfide as a salt is a yellow-orange tablet or powder, and they can be non-toxic when taken orally, and they are non-carcinogenic when they're applied topically. So it can be effective for hyperkeratosis on body surfaces besides the palms and soles, as was described in this case series. They used it on the distal legs as well. They did have to have application for at least 10 minutes to see therapeutic benefit, which I thought was interesting. The potential benefit from it might be because it actually reduces the mitotic rate and cell turnover of the epidermal basal layer due to a cytostatic effect that it has on epidermal keratinocytes as well as follicular epithelium. So that cytostatic effect on follicular epithelium is why I'm not in love with it for like general hair, although it might be helpful for hyperkeratotic disorders of the scalp. And that's when I actually do use it because it can diminish the formation rate of the stratum corneum. It can also be interestingly associated with increased sebum excretion rate, which sounds like it would be counterproductive for seborrheic dermatitis, but it's therapeutic because it kills the yeast that can cause that problem. And topical selenium sulfide has also been studied to treat psoriasis in over 100 patients in a study where they similarly applied the shampoo to affected sites and allowed it to remain on 15 minutes before they washed it off. So selenium sulfide, easy to access, safe in the forms that it's available over the counter, very well tolerated and broadly applicable for multiple different hyperkeratoses of different origins. So they had lymphedema associated unethos, which was inherited, and hyperkeratosis related to immobility. The first patient had spina bifida, and so she wasn't walking on her feet, and she had that hyperkeratosis that people get when they don't walk.
So it's so cool. Wild. I would never have guessed that selenium sulfide could be used for this.
Me neither. The cytostatic effect was pretty cool to read about, actually, and it makes sense. Like, it slows down the turnover rate of the epidermis, because I'd always understood that it could be a little toxic to hair follicles, but I was like, why is it that way? But that makes sense now. So if I've got a hyperkeratotic scalp situation going on, I'm down with using the selenium sulfide.
And you can buy the 2.5% lotion or shampoo over the counter, it looks like, though, like, mm-hmm. Normal strength Selsun Blue is 1%, so you might want to get the extra strength version or something. The super cheap, but they're not that bad. It looks like a big bottle of 2.5% lotion is about $20.
Yeah. It's pretty easy to access.
Well, let's move on and talk about something that I sometimes feel angst about as a pediatric dermatologist, which is basically whether or not I should prescribe epinephrine auto-injectors to my patients with a disease that used to be called urticaria pigmentosa. So this was a study from Pediatric Dermatology, the journal, a couple years ago in 2021, called Anaphylaxis and Epinephrine Auto-Injector Use in Pediatric Patients with Cutaneous Mastocytosis. The authors include a couple people who will be mispronounced as follows. Aysegul Ertuğrul and Ilknur Bostancı from Turkey. Appropriate to talk about them right after Thanksgiving. So mastocytosis. So mastocytosis, which is sort of a proliferation of mast cells, comes in three versions. Mast cell sarcoma, which we never really talk about in dermatology. Systemic mastocytosis, which we talk about sometimes and is divided into several types. And cutaneous mastocytosis, which only affects the skin, and so we talk about it most of the time if we're talking about mastocytosis. And especially in kids, we think a lot more about cutaneous mastocytosis than these other types. And cutaneous mastocytosis comes itself in three varieties. A solitary mastocytoma.
Those are the cute ones. I love those. They look like a mole of mast cells. They're kind of adorable to look at under the microscope.
And I think a lot of us have seen them clinically, too. They're little yellow-brown, almost leathery papules. And these are the ones where if you rub them a lot, they urticate, turn into a hive, which is called Darier's sign. So it's always nice to kind of prove the diagnosis right in clinic. Then there is, again, what used to be called urticaria pigmentosa, but is now called maculopapular cutaneous mastocytosis.
That's so annoying.
MPCM, which is basically a whole bunch of mastocytomas all over you. And then there's this something else called diffuse cutaneous mastocytosis, which is quite rare.
Unfortunately, it's rare because it's not nice.
Yeah, it's the worst of them. So MPCM, maculopapular cutaneous
mastocytosis. We encoded maculopapular, and it is accurate because they can be macular or they can be papular, but okay.
Formerly urticaria pigmentosa, or UP.
It's the condition formerly known as urticaria pigmentosa.
That's right.
It's like
It apparently accounts for 70 to 90% of pediatric cutaneous mastocytosis, though I swear I see more patients with solitary mastocytomas than this disease. So again, should kids with MPCM carry around epinephrine auto-injectors? And I'm just going to call those EpiPens, even though I know that's a brand name. So I thought the state of the art was no, that they didn't actually get anaphylaxis more than anyone else. And I've seen issues with EpiPens. So they cost money. They're inconvenient.
You got to go to the ER if you use them.
About them. You got to go to the ER if you use them. And they're just like kind of annoying. I remember having patients who are like, well, can you prescribe me three, like one for me and one for dad's house and maybe one for the school. And then they expire in a year or something. And so they have to re-up their prescription. And then the most concerning issue, in my opinion, is that I feel like I have seen caregivers treat kids differently if they have an EpiPen around. They treat them as more fragile, perhaps, or more at risk, and so they don't have them do things as often, or they at least treat them more gingerly. And I worry that that has an effect on how kids grow and develop. So I was happy to say, okay, the answer is no, don't have to worry about it. I can just reassure people and say, see if there's a problem. But again, after a discussion at Grand Rounds at the University of Utah, I wanted to make sure I re-educated myself, and thus I found this article. It's a case series of 53 pediatric patients with MPCM, and two of them, 4%, developed anaphylaxis during the study period of 5 years, and three patients, 6%, used their EpiPens, and this group just gave them to everybody. And so their conclusion was that everyone with MPCM should get an EpiPen and be trained how and when to use them so parents feel comfortable doing so. The two anaphylaxis responses in their group, one was to intramuscular ceftriaxone, that was a 16-month-old patient, and the other was to a bee sting in a 15-month-old. And then the three people who used EpiPens, one was that patient with the bee sting-induced anaphylaxis in subsequent episodes. That first time, nobody knew that they had this disease or was allergic to bees. And then one patient whose lesions became inflamed after an insect bite but didn't meet criteria for anaphylaxis. And then one patient used theirs due to widespread flushing with no obvious trigger. Again, didn't meet criteria for anaphylaxis. So, darn it. Should I actually be giving these people EpiPens? Should I call all of my patients who have this disease and say, hey, it looks like I was wrong. Let's reevaluate you and prescribe you one of these EpiPens. Well, I still think it's not clear. So here are some points from the article. So is this rate of two people out of 53 over 5 years more than expected in the general population? Well, they say the incidence of anaphylaxis in kids has been reported in widely varying numbers, anywhere from 1 to 761 per 100,000 person years. So in this current study, which is two people per 265 person years, translates to 754 per 100,000 person years, which is within that range of 1 to 761, if we're saying that's somehow supposed to be normal, but certainly on the high range, so that makes me nervous. Both kids with anaphylaxis in this group were toddlers, right? 15 and 16 months old. So maybe like that's a more at-risk group. And if I see somebody who's four, we can think we're out of the woods. It's tough to say for sure. The numbers just aren't very high to make conclusions like that. There was a 2020 study of 227 children with MPCM from five institutions that showed that these patients did not have higher rates of anaphylaxis. Great. Maybe that's why I thought I didn't have to prescribe them EpiPens. But they also say there was a 2015 study that compared 11 studies and reported the prevalence of anaphylaxis in this population was sort of disconcertingly high, between 1.5 and 9%. So that ain't good. So They have this quote in the article that says, "The lack of objective criteria and high-quality evidence makes the decision on prescribing EpiPens for pediatric patients with cutaneous mastocytosis difficult. According to a 2020 review of the literature, an EpiPen is required for patients with diffuse cutaneous mastocytosis," okay, but almost nobody has that, "but it's not required for patients with a mastocytoma," okay, and then they say, "prescription for EpiPens for patients with MPCM is at the discretion of the provider based on the patient's symptoms." Okay, so maybe I was exercising my discretion. They say widespread lesions with severe symptoms or a prior severe reaction is an indicator for recommendation. Okay, so that still like doesn't give me a clear direction. And then they have another quote, "diffuse cutaneous mastocytosis, extensive cutaneous involvement, severe systemic symptoms, and high tryptase levels are known risk factors for potential anaphylactic reactions in pediatric cutaneous mastocytosis. Familial cases and high serum tryptase level correlate with systemic symptoms, which presumes a greater risk of anaphylaxis." And they say, "to date, there are no high-quality, evidence-based objective criteria or consensus guidelines available to determine the need for EpiPens in patients with cutaneous mastocytosis."
Interesting. Like, one of the things I think that worries me more in kids with mastocytosis is that there's many anesthesiologists and CNAs that do know how to take care of children with mastocytosis, but there is a disturbing number of them that do not know how to do this correctly yet either. And you do have to think about perioperative management as well as radiographic dyes being potential mast cell degranulators in these patients. So I actually worry more about them going into an acute care setting and getting exposed to some pharmacotherapy that might cause massive degranulation of their mast cells and put them into a hypotensive episode that might be difficult to deal with than, you know, random anaphylaxis. I don't know. Have you ever dealt with that or counseled about that, Luke?
Yeah, I do counsel about that as my default for these patients. I say, you know, normally we don't worry about this, but there are some medicines, especially those used in anesthesiology, that have been shown to sometimes be an issue. So if you have to have anesthesia for some reason, make sure you let them know you have this. I guess the good news is that they're in a pretty controlled medical environment in those settings, but of course we don't want surprises. So there's still like not a good answer. And they also, like, for example, they say, quote, "the extent of skin involvement is not directly associated with symptoms, and patients with a single lesion may generate systemic symptoms," but they don't have a reference for that. And I feel like I have not seen a patient with a single mastocytoma have systemic symptoms that we attributed to mast cell release.
Yeah,
so
I agree.
I still don't know. And they're, you know, they say, you know, familial cases, high serum tryptase levels could correlate with anaphylaxis, but that really wasn't the case in their series here. Those two patients who had anaphylaxis had tryptase levels that were in the normal range. So I just don't know. Now I'm probably going to have to like have a conversation about this with my families, which is like the worst of all possible worlds. I can't say everything's fine. I can't say, okay, everyone agrees you should use this epinephrine auto-injector. I have to be like, well, there's some research that says that your son might be at a slightly higher risk of anaphylaxis. So some dermatologists would say you should carry around an EpiPen just to be extra safe. I think there's pros and cons to that. What do you want to do? Except I probably wouldn't try to say it so despairingly. And then the other issue, of course, is that they have to be trained how to use it. And I don't know how to use them. I suppose I can look up a YouTube video or something, and my staff doesn't know how to use them or how to train people. As far as I know, I think one of my colleagues prescribes these frequently, so maybe we have staff members who do know how to do it. So I suppose that's where I landed on this, which is, again, the worst of all possible worlds. So we need our mast cell disease experts to come give us some guidelines.
You know, the EpiPens, if you have an actual EpiPen, they're not that hard to use. It's kind of got the similar mechanism to the auto-injector pens for the biologics. A lot of people were dealing with syringes when the EpiPen's price got inflated so severely. And, you know, that's used like a regular syringe. So in terms of the mechanics of it, it's not that difficult. You kind of inject it the same places you would inject a psoriasis biologic. The biggest thing is that you just have to go to the emergency room afterward to manage the side effects of the massive dose of epinephrine that you've just given, sometimes a very small baby. And you do want to make sure that the doses are appropriate for the size of the child. So
a couple other points before we move on, just sort of more mast cell stuff. So males predominate over females, at least in this case series, at a 2-to-1 ratio. And then if you're wondering if your patient with mast cell disease might have symptoms that could be attributed to their mast cells, well, we know about flushing, pruritus, blistering of their lesions, abdominal pain, diarrhea, shortness of breath, but they also included headache, irritability, and anxiety within the list of symptoms that could be attributed. And who doesn't have irritability and anxiety? So I think I might have mast cell disease.
That's gotta be it. Well, to correct myself, I think, or maybe from earlier, the unethost is non-transgradients. So that means it stops kind of abruptly at the edges of the hands and feet. So just for clarity. And we're talking about mast cells, which can urticate and be itchy and red around the lesion. So another thing where you get red, itchy things around a lesion is Meyerson's phenomenon. Do you remember the so-called Meyerson's nevus, Luke?
You know, I didn't. This is yet another article that came out from our Grand Rounds discussion. So I'm awfully glad that I attend Grand Rounds. If you're at an academic institution, you should attend your Grand Rounds.
Grand Rounds is awesome. So Meyerson phenomenon, also called halodermatitis or halo eczema, is an eczematous reaction with erythema and scaling associated with often with pruritus that develops around a pre-existing cutaneous lesion. It's best known in the Meyerson's nevus fame. So this is a benign nevus that has eczema around it. But Meyerson's phenomenon has also been described with a myriad of other benign and malignant cutaneous lesions, including melanoma, capillary malformation, sebderms, and dermatofibromas. So the paper here, which is a case report out of JAD Case Reports by authors Anna...
Sorry to interrupt, but you said it's been shown to be around sebderms. I assume
I did say sebderms. I meant sebcares, and I was like, if I keep going, he won't notice. Sebcares, yes. Sebderms aren't a thing, really, unless you have dermatologists that are very sebaceous, and then supposedly they could be sebderms. Sebcares. You can have a seborrheic keratosis with a Meyerson's phenomenon.
If I had taken two courses of isotretinoin, I would be a sebderm.
But I don't pump up. I love that. So, Meyerson's phenomenon. Halo eczema or halodermatitis. All right, so melanocytic nevi are the most common type of lesion this occurs with, but the authors of this paper out of JAD Case Report, which is Anna Eliza Verzi, who is, I'm presuming, not a sebderm, and Francesco Lacuraba, who is possibly also not a sebderm. These are out of the University of Catania, Italy. Yep. And the Dermatology Clinic of Catania, Italy. Very cool. That's a cool place. So they have described two cases of dermatofibromas with Meyerson's phenomenon with dermoscopy and reflectance confocal microscopy findings, as well as a literature review. So this was a nice presentation of this phenomenon in two patients. Both of them had erythematous to brownish patches with irregular but well-demarcated margins, surrounded by eczema, very characteristic of dermatofibromas. They had on dermoscopy a white network with brownish globule-like structures, which is relatively typical of especially larger dermatofibromas on the leg, and focal dotted vessels, which you can see around dermatofibromas. And they also saw the peripheral area with yellow-orange scales and polymorphous vessels with an erythematous background, which was the eczema, basically. They did dermoscopy and reflectance confocal microscopy on both of these lesions. The other lesion was a grayish firm nodule, about 1.5 centimeters in diameter on the leg as well, that was surrounded with an itchy erythematous brownish patch. On dermoscopy, it showed a white network as well with diffuse yellow-orange scales over an erythematous background. And both of these patients also subsequently treated the lesions with corticosteroids with resolution of the dermatitis and more clear appreciation of the dermatofibroma. They did a very nice job describing the reflectance confocal microscopy findings of the dermatofibromas, which they also showed very nicely in the figures in the article. Specifically, what you see is what they call edged dermal papillae. And so what I want you to think about with that is reflectance confocal microscopy gets the best bounce off of melanin, right? And so we know that melanin is hypersynthesized in the elongated reedy ridges of a dermatofibroma. So when you think about the architecture of a dermatofibroma, you have hyperkeratosis, and then you have these elongated, hyperpigmented reedy ridges that are, in my opinion, pointing down in the dermis going, the action's actually down there. I know you're seeing the pigment up here, but look down there. So that pigment is kind of a overproduction of melanin, not an increase in actual melanocytes. But what you see on reflectance confocal microscopy is the light sort of bouncing off of the melanin around those dermal papillae, and you get these edged dermal papillae that are relatively characteristic for dermatofibromas. So they had that nice description of that. When they were looking at the eczematous areas, they also saw bright signals coming off of the inflammatory cells, which is something else that you can see on RCM when you're dealing with eczematous lesions. And then they did a nice job of demonstrating resolution with topical corticosteroids with more typical appearance of the dermatofibroma subsequent to that treatment. And they even did a biopsy to prove that it was indeed a dermatofibroma that had this significant dermatitis develop on top of it. So they then looked into the literature and looked at all case reports of Meyerson's phenomenon. And of course, the most common reporting of this was with Meyerson's nevus, melanocytic nevus, either congenital or acquired, with eczema surrounding it. Eczema has also been described surrounding melanoma, so Meyerson's phenomenon is not restricted to benign melanocytic neoplasia. And as we said, has been reported also with seborrheic keratoses, not sebderms, and capillary malformations, as well as other dermatofibromas in the literature, sebaceous nevi, scars, basal cell carcinoma, things like that. The reason that this happens is not clear. There have been multiple theories proposed. Sunburns can sometimes trigger this. Interferon treatment has been indicated as a causative agent. Laser therapy is a trigger factor. From over 160 cases of both benign and malignant lesions, they were able to kind of show a preponderance of melanocytic neoplasia, but it isn't, of course, restricted to that. And it can be characterized based off of the typical clinical presentation, which is an erythematous halo with yellow crusts and a scaly surface. We all kind of know what eczema looks like. Usually this will respond well to topical corticosteroids. I've actually seen this in a mast cell tumor. So a benign mastocytoma that had Meyerson's phenomenon surrounding it that we treated with topical corticosteroids to prove that it was actually a nice little mast cell, and it looked perfect as a mastocytoma afterward. Not a single mast cell, a mastocytoma after we treated it with the topical corticosteroids, and we're just following it clinically because it's isolated and the child is otherwise healthy. But this did a great job of explaining the reflectance confocal microscopy findings of both Meyerson's phenomenon and dermatofibromas, as well as bringing it to our attention that this itchy phenomenon can also affect DFs.
So I often see eczematous thin plaques over port wine stains and nevus simplex. Mm-hmm. Is that this?
Probably, because that has also been reported around capillary malformations, and it's likely just a kind of immune response to the local neoplasia. Like I said, they don't really have a good bead on the etiopathogenesis of this presentation. There's lots of theories about it. We know that a lot of these benign lesions have mutations in them. And what I've always thought about is that something draws the immune system's attention, and then the immune system gets kind of mad that that thing is there. It's like, why is this here? Ah, and it makes sort of an ineffective immune response to it.
Interesting. Because we see that quite a lot, and oftentimes I just tell parents, yeah, for reasons we don't understand, eczema likes to go to these sorts of birthmarks, but yeah. I hadn't called that Meyerson phenomenon, at least in my head. Maybe it is. So if it's around a mole, do I need to worry that it's melanoma? Is this a potential warning sign, or do I just need to like ensure that the mole itself looks okay?
The way that I handle them is I treat the eczema and I re-examine the nevus once the eczema is resolved. You certainly can get some post-inflammatory pigment change after you've had an episode of inflammation over a melanocytic nevus. So you have to kind of interpret around that. But I use, of course, dermoscopy, sequential photography, and I try to treat the eczema so we can get a better picture of what we're actually dealing with underneath the inflammation. I don't know that it's got any kind of indication that the lesion itself is benign. It's sort of like the halo phenomenon when we talk about halo nevi. Most commonly, if you have a haloed melanocytic lesion, it's going to be a halo nevus, not a halo melanoma. But you have to interpret the lesion at the center of the reaction with a grain of salt. Like, do I feel like this lesion is benign or malignant? And then give it your, you know, full consideration and appropriate follow-up. I think with halo melanomas, it tends to be asymmetric. So if you have an asymmetric halo, that makes me worried.
But not an asymmetric Meyerson phenomenon.
Meyerson's is almost always asymmetric, so I don't really put as much emphasis on the symmetric nature of that inflammatory infiltrate. But a halo that's asymmetric around a melanocytic lesion gives me pause.
All right. Well, we're taking a little tour of Europe here. We were in Turkey and then Italy, and now let's go to Spain to talk about Langerhans-Cell histiocytosis, LCH. So this is out of the International Journal of Pediatric Otorhinolaryngology.
Nice.
And it's called Langerhans-Cell histiocytosis of the head and neck in the pediatric population in a tertiary center. Clinical presentation, classification, and treatment out of Spain, like I mentioned. Authors include Ma Piedad Garcia Diaz and Miguel Armengot Carcelier.
That was very well done. Nice job.
Fake it till you make it. So I had a patient with cutaneous LCH who had, quote, ear swelling. And I didn't realize that it could be related to his LCH because it seemed like it was just confined to his skin. And they came in for follow-up and I said, yeah, things are still looking pretty good. And they said, well, sometimes his ear gets kind of swollen and red. And I said, well, I don't really think that's related. I think that happened to me when I was a kid, and buried in some paragraph somewhere in one of the textbooks is something referred to as otomalalgia that apparently kids occasionally can get. But then that patient followed up with their oncology team and they were like, sent me a message saying, since he had some ear symptoms, we think this is systemic now, so we're going to treat him with these chemotherapeutic agents. And I thought, whoa, I missed that one. I didn't think they were related at all. So I thought I should educate myself about that head and neck and specifically the ear symptoms that could be associated with LCH. And that's what this article's for. It's a case series of 20 patients with LCH from an ENT perspective. It's from their literature. So Langerhans-Cell histiocytosis, LCH, is a proliferative disorder, though apparently no one's decided yet if it is truly neoplastic or it's something else, like some kind of reactive process. It affects males preferentially at a 2.5 to 1 ratio, and genetics plays a role. So there's a 92% concordance in monozygotic twins versus a 10% concordance in dizygotic twins.
Intriguing.
So I hope you or Becca don't get it, because then you know the other one's doomed.
Doomed!
Diagnosing it requires histologic evaluation. Michelle, you're the dermatopathologist. So what do we see for histology for LCH?
All right, so the first thing that you're going to see is a very busy dermis with space in it. So there's almost always extra space in Langerhans-Cell histiocytosis, and this is one of the ways that it's easier to diagnose from low power. So you can see an infiltrate with large mononuclear cells that have a lot of cytoplasm, and often they have kind of this kidney bean-shaped or coffee bean-shaped nucleus, reniform nucleus. And then there's also a lot of other inflammatory cells usually in the mix. So lymphocytes, eosinophils, sometimes extravasated red blood cells. Langerhans cells are epidermal residents, so they can be epidermotropic, and there can even be collections of them in the epidermis. And there's often large collections of them in the dermis as well, sometimes so solid that they kind of look like a nevus, but they're very discohesive. And that's one of the ways that you can tell it apart from other things that can kind of colonize the dermis. So it can help you distinguish it from things like mastocytoma, which can also be large mononuclear cells that have a fair amount of cytoplasm. But they don't tend to have that much space, and they don't tend to be as messy. So LCH tends to be kind of messy. It also has often a lot of edema associated with it, so that can be helpful.
And what are those fancy stains you guys use to prove it?
Ah, so we can use all kinds of stains. One of the ones that we sometimes use is Langerin. So Langerin, very nice. I believe that that stain's actually the Birkbeck granules, which is super fun. You can also use CD1A, which intriguingly stains an infectious microorganism, but not all clones of the stain do this. Do you know which infectious microorganism it stains, Luke? It's okay if you don't. This is mean.
Sure don't.
It's Leishmaniasis. Isn't that crazy? Why? But it's only specific clones of the stain that will actually pick up Leishmaniasis with CD1A.
S100. Stains had clones.
Yes, yeah. So they're antibodies, right? So they're different antibodies that are made when you're using immunohistochemistry, not special stains like GIMSA or GMS. Those are different. But if you're talking about immunohistochemical stains, they're an antibody, and each antibody is not necessarily made the same exact way. So different manufacturers have different clones of those stains. So Attack of the Clones, actually, very interesting. And then wow. S100, of course, yeah.
And Langerin is also known as CD207, I think.
That is correct.
And you might recall that these Langerhans cells have these little tiny granules called Birkbeck granules that kind of look like snowshoes or tennis rackets and electron microscopy, which we don't really use anymore. But if you get some kind of test question about it, there you go.
That is correct.
So you can see bone lesions on X-ray. They're often referred to as punched out lesions because that's the most common part of the body to be affected by LCH is the skeleton. And now we can find genetic mutations. So they're usually in the MAP kinase pathway. So BRAF inhibitors like vemurafenib are seeing increased use, though I don't think they're approved for this condition. There's some pretty good-looking case series that have come out. So as I mentioned, in LCH, the bones are the most likely to be affected. That's in 80% of people. The mean age of presentation is 6 years, which is older than I thought. I normally think of it as in babies, and indeed, apparently the peak incidence is 1 to 3 years. But in this series of these patients, the mean age was six. Mm-hmm. And the most common ENT signs and symptoms were a palpable skull tumor and headache. And then mm-hmm. some others that did occur were otorrhea, so drainage from the ear, especially if it was bloody, granulation tissue or polyps in the auditory canal, post-auricular swelling, so swelling behind the ear, not the ear swelling itself, which is what my patient was experiencing, but this post-auricular swelling, they say similar to acute mastoiditis. So you know, if you feel behind your ear, there's that little bony bump, that's your mastoid process. So apparently it can become inflamed, and that's the part that swells up potentially. Mm-hmm. And then neck lymphadenopathy. Other reports have described pre-auricular swelling and subjective hearing loss as potential manifestations. And they say be especially careful if you think your patient has ear stuff, because the base of the skull could be considered in the high-risk CNS category for LCH and requires some different treatment. So I think this is most useful if, in situations like my patient that I had, if we have a patient who seems to have cutaneous LCH but doesn't have other symptoms, but they start reporting some of these other issues, then this would be a time to say, hey, you should go see your oncology team or your ENT doctor so they can make sure this isn't related. It's interesting that this study didn't mention at all auricular swelling specifically, just pre or post swelling, but again, you got to be cautious, I guess, because these high-risk CNS locations are, well, they're called high-risk for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
The classification of the Langerhans cell histiocytosis has changed over time. So when I was training, and when I was training you, Luke, I think that the shift actually happened during your training. But the old names used to be, you know, Hashimoto Pritzker, Hanschiller Christian's disease, letter CV.
Yeah.
You know,
histiocytosis X.
So they've kind of renamed these things now based off of their presentation. So they've gone from these kind of eponymous names to basically locational names. So there's unifocal, which we would have used to call eosinophilic granuloma, which is a misnomer, because it is a proliferation of Langerhans cells, not eosinophils. But unifocal LCH, which is what we would have called eosinophilic granuloma, where you'd have, you know, a single lesion, and that's causing damage in one place, basically. So it can be found in the skin, where you would have cutaneous, like Langerhans cell histiocytosis. You could have the multifocal unisystem, which we used to call Hanschuller Christian, which is like diabetes insipidus, exophthalmos, and lytic bone lesions. Like, that's the multifocal unisystem. And the multifocal multisystem is the one we used to call letter or CWE. And I liked that name because I would be, don't let her see me like this, because it's like the worst one. So like, it was multifocal multisystem. And that can be where Langerhans cells are basically proliferating in many different tissues and can cause hepatosplenomegaly. And it's associated with very poor prognosis and usually needs chemotherapy. And then there's this pulmonary Langerhans cell histiocytosis, which is usually seen in people who smoke. And it's a kind of interstitial lung disease that happens. So those classification systems have kind of changed over time, and they're now locational and extension based versus these eponymous names, which makes it confusing when you're looking through the literature.
And it can look like a lot of things, including on the skin. It's probably worth calling it one of our great mimics. This review specifically said it, quote, may present itself with an infinity of signs and symptoms. Hard to get bigger than infinity.
And beyond.
So I'll be on the lookout for ear stuff and bone tumors. So if they can palpate something. So headache and bone tumor were the most, skull tumor, were the most common ENT signs in this series. So watch for that in your patients with cutaneous LCH.
If you have, go ahead.
That's probably all we have time for, I was about to say, Michelle. So thanks, listeners, for hanging out with us today. Thanks, of course, to our institutions. Thanks to the University of Utah for supporting the podcast. And thanks to Texas Tech for lending us Michelle, their chair. I'm sure she has much better things to do than be hanging around making a podcast. So especially happy to still have her around. Also very happy to have our medical students. We have a team of medical students who are helping out behind the scenes. Team Dermosphere, among other things, they keep our social media accounts moving along. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And our team, there's going to be some turnover here, listeners, because we are pleased to say goodbye and good luck to some of our longtime team members because they're graduating and they're going to be, you know, interns and then I presume and hope dermatology residents. So we'll cut them loose from their duties here. But thanks very much to Morgan Dykeman, Guy Kusecki, Eleonora Marcacci, Michael Birdsall, Angie Wong, Laura Dela Cruz, Jordan Easterling, Austin Callister, and Nicole Babkowski for all of your help. In addition to social media, they also maintain our website, dermospherepodcast.com, which has links to all of the articles that we discussed, as well as our entire archive of episodes. And it's also a good way to reach out to us. Listeners, if you would like to reach out to us and give us money, who am I to say no? We now have a way that you can donate to us if you feel like we've brought some value to your life. There will be a link in the show notes, but it's uofuhealth.org/dermosphere. And you can also find some video content, again, thanks to Team Dermosphere, on YouTube and also a platform called ViewMedi, which we'll put in the show notes as well. And finally, if you want to hang out with occasionally myself and some other U of U dermatologists for our monthly echo sessions, we would love to have you there. They're free. You get some CME out of it. You learn a little something. And then if you want, you can present some cases as well. Michelle, anything you'd like to say before we say ta-ta?
I just want to say thank to everybody for listening. You know, we have some ideas for how to support our students that are working with us. That's kind of where we're going with the donations thing. So the future is bright for Dermosphere, and I will continue to be devoted to learning and talking with you guys. I enjoy it very much.
And the end of the year is coming up, so happy holidays. And also the end of the year means the 2023 Dermy Awards are fast approaching. We give out some awards at the end of every year, and we're going to have an audience choice category, so be watching our social media so you can vote. And we'll see you guys in 2 weeks. Have a good one.